Welcome to The Squeal, PIC's Swine Management Podcast, featuring in-depth conversations on topics that matter to you. PIC is the global leader in swine genetics. At PIC, our goal is to make our customers the most successful pig producers by providing them with the best genetics. We know our business success depends on yours. African swine fever, or ASF, is a critical issue for the global pork production industry. PIC's health and technical services team spent a recent afternoon with Dr. Jose Manuel Sanchez Vizcaína to better understand the history, dispersal, and future impact of ASF. Afterwards, Dr. Tim Snyder, Health Assurance Director for PIC Europe, Dr. Jean-Paul Cano, Health Assurance Director, PIC Americas, and Dr. Marissa Rotolo, Health Assurance Veterinarian, sat down to discuss the presentation and their thoughts.
Jean-Paul, this afternoon, you spent a wonderful afternoon listening to one of the foremost experts in the world. Tell us about him. How did he happen to be here? How did he come to be here?
Absolutely. What a privilege to have Dr. Jose Manuel Sanchez Vizcaína from Universidad Complutense de Madrid here with us. PIC has always had a great relationship with Dr. Jose Manuel, and we had a chance to bring him to our Global Health Assurance meeting. And to just hear about the most recent update on ASF research, learn a little bit about the history, about the virus transmission, and then the potential strategies that could be in place for elimination and containment. So it was very good opportunity for our team to get up to speed with all the information and get trained on that.
PIC, of course, in an excellent position to look at issues from a global perspective, ASF being one of them. Talk about that for a minute.
PIC is a company with global presence and with a very clear goal of delivering supply and genetic improvement to our customers and producers. So we believe that we have a key role on these kind of situations, a global disease with a tremendous impact. One of them is, of course, keep our multiplication, the genetic improvement, healthy so we can continue to help those producers to make progress. That's the first one. The second one is help to share information that we get across, leveraging our global presence and our global network, to share all that information with those customers and stakeholders in the countries that we operate on. That's the second one. And finally is, can we share our experience, our knowledge, our networking with local authorities, so with governments, with the veterinarians and the producers of each one of those industries to positively influence the way that they take decisions to protect their industries. Because it's in our best interest to reduce the impact of disease and prevent transmission globally. So that's pretty much the key for us.
An interesting comment from Dr. Manuel today related to culture, societal pressures. It's not just a matter of picking up a plan or a program in one location and taking it to another. How does PIC look at that globally?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And we've been talking about biosecurity for many years. And more recently, we have made a tremendous emphasis on culture. We believe that biosecurity has your protocols, your plans, your infrastructure, but if you don't create, if you don't build a culture that everybody's living that on a daily basis, you're not successful. So this is the same. It's promoting that culture, getting closer to the people that are taking decisions on a daily basis at a slot level, and to be able to train them so they can take those decisions thinking in biosecurity to protect the farms. That's the only way to protect our farms and our customers' farms.
Tim, from your perspective, walk us through some of the issues dealing with that in your experience, in your area of coverage, your work zone. What were some of the challenges beyond the obvious of we're sick, how do we deal with that? What were the challenges that you thought were really interesting as you learned through that experience?
Well, I'm coming from, I worked in Canada for 20 years as a practitioner, then in the United States for 6 or 7 years before moving to Europe. And so I come with a North American perspective into that environment. I moved there in 2017, right? And they had ASF at their doorstep since 2007, right? Spreading through Russia, and then by 2014, it was getting into the Baltic states and Poland and so on. So, the EU was really working out a lot of regulatory steps, similar to what the U.S. is doing as far as preparedness and response planning goes. Here we talk about private-public partnerships, right? With academia to move those things ahead, and in the EU there was a lot of that sort of thing going on as well, mostly on the public side. But it was, I think they've developed some really very nice planning for individual member states to follow within the EU when, if and when they are affected by African swine fever. And I guess for us, I think understanding what would happen in a scenario where there's an outbreak is very helpful for us to know what to expect as far as how our business continuity will be affected in the face of an outbreak, both for PIC and also for our customers, right? So, but when the Czech Republic broke in 2017, summer 2017, that was really my first experience with an outbreak within our region. And of course, the response of our customer base was very interesting, right? As well as understanding the real-time response of the EU. So I really learned firsthand, you know, it would be similar to if there would be an outbreak in a state within the United States, really, because the way pigs move within the member states is kind of it's a united group of states, really, but they're independent states, of course. So the response was very interesting. You had the regulatory response, but then, as we all know, the regulatory response is one thing, but then how countries that you trade with, that response is a whole different thing. And so, some countries closed their doors to the Czech Republic, even though it was zoned in a small area, a matter of, six to 10 kilometers initially, and the rest of the country was perfectly fine. Even our customers, some of them said, we don't want to take from the Czech Republic, even though our farms were 400 kilometers away and everything was under control. But we worked through that process. And I guess then we really started to gain an understanding about what was happening within the country, how the regulations worked, the steps they had to follow. In this case, it was only a feral swine outbreak as opposed to a domestic pig outbreak. So in the EU, they have a different protocol for feral swine outbreaks versus domestic swine versus an outbreak detected at a slaughter plant or during transport. And there's three different regulatory processes you would follow for that. So, really we had to get educated on that. I think in the same way that veterinarians would need to become educated here. Now, last year we joined with Russia as part of our region. And Russia's been dealing with it for over 10 years, right? So they have a lot of things in place that are quite impressive as far as how to deal with an outbreak. We have a farm affected in the Kursk region, which is very close to our head office. It's sort of the Iowa of Russia as far as pig density goes. And the pigs in the affected control zone that have a high biosecurity classification have continued to ship pigs because they're already, they've basically got their secure pork plan in place from a law regulatory standpoint. So they're very advanced that way because they've been dealing with it for a long time. So those are some of the things that for me were really interesting, especially after working on some of the secure plans here, pork plans, turkey and egg, we were just chatting about here in the U.S. It's very comparable, I think.
Marissa, what is our status currently here in the U.S., not regarding ASF, but regarding our planning processes? Are you've been involved in that very deeply. How far along are we? Do we feel like we are in a position where we know we're doing as much as we can with what we know?
I think for us in the U.S., we have made a lot of progress since China announced that they had positive ASF cases. For example, that was the driver for developing a new integrated swine hemorrhagic fever surveillance program. So essentially, previous to the outbreak in China of ASF, we had a classical swine fever surveillance program in this country, and we decided to add on African swine fever to that. So we piggybacked off of our old surveillance plan and added African swine fever to it. And we also tailored it down to make it a more effective program. So what we've essentially done is we looked at the two diseases, we found sample types that would work for both, and we found clinical signs that work for both, essentially. So really what it is a nice comprehensive surveillance program that focuses on our populations that have the highest risk if they were to break, mostly our commercial sites. And what we have now is the ability to track or demonstrate support for disease freedom for African swine fever as well as classical swine fever. So for example, for our commercial sites, any lymph node, tonsil, or spleen that is submitted to a known diagnostic lab that's able to do testing for ASF and CSF that follows a certain set of criteria can be selected for PCR testing for classical swine fever and African swine fever. So we are able to have this sort of monitoring program, surveillance program for ASF and CSF right now that we didn't have before. And the reason that we have it today is because China broke with African swine fever. I was working at the Center of Epidemiology and Animal Health. We got the news that China had broke with African swine fever, and maybe 2 days later, I was assigned to develop a new integrated swine fever surveillance plan. And on top of that, what we have also been doing for the USDA, or what the USDA has also been doing, is putting on a series of exercises and discussions. So getting industry stakeholders, USDA personnel, state animal health officials, producers, veterinarians in the same room and talking through what would happen if we had a ASF outbreak in the states. Specifically looking at how are we going to do a national standstill? What sampling requirements are we going to have? What are we going to need in order to move pigs and maintain business continuity? So that has really been a good driver for us. And I would say in terms of preparedness, we're a lot better than we were previous to China breaking with African swine fever. I think we have a goal and we have a way forward. So as of right now, we've had a lot of discussions, and then at the end of September, we'll be doing a fully functional exercise, so basically a dress rehearsal for a foreign animal disease outbreak. So we'll be going to sites across the 14 top swine-producing states, collecting samples, submitting them to the Foreign Animal Disease Diagnostic Lab at Plum Island, having state animal health officials come to the farm, creating control areas, doing sampling requirements, talking through how we would do a depop, repop, how we would maintain business continuity. So we are in a lot better position than we were previously, but we do have a little bit more to go. But we have a plan, we have a goal, and we're well on our way to be more prepared than we were yesterday.
Excellent. Tim, you reacted to Dr. Manuel's risk assessment. I thought that interesting, that part of the reason he evaluated the U.S. as a higher risk is because of our interaction with China. Your thoughts on that, and especially as related, again, to your viewpoint from Europe's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think about a lot is that in Europe, the focus isn't very, I mean, they look at it, but you don't hear as much focus on feed ingredients and feed as a risk as we do currently, I think, in the U.S. and Canada, in the Americas in general. And I'm not sure why that is, right? Europe has to import a lot of their feedstuffs, you know, and they rely a lot on byproducts as for ingredients. But a lot of their cereal grains come in from all over the world, right? And ingredients. And I don't think they have many other options, but to do that. Whereas in the Americas, we can maybe look at supplying, I'm not sure 100%, but supplying more, being more autonomous in some situations, right? Yeah, especially for the grains, yeah. But one thing I took away from it as well is that I think he believes, my sense is, he also doesn't rank it as high as a risk. That was my interpretation of his message, but that he felt that the movement of infected food was more likely to be how it would move. And we certainly see, you know, it's very analogous in Europe to the Americas as far as how people from other nations often fill the labor roles in our farms. So whereas we see Latin Americans, I think, in the United States often being in farms, And in many cases, well, certainly in Western Canada, where I used to work, a lot of Filipinos working on farms. In Europe, we see, in Western Europe, we see a lot of Eastern Europeans. Sometimes complete staffs in the large farms are all from countries like Romania, Bulgaria, Moldavia, the countries that are affected right now. Poland used to be a big supplier of workers, but when their economy turned around, those workers went home, right? But there's a lot of movement. And when he talks about cultural norms as far as food and stuff goes, they'll go home for holidays, right? So if you have a lot of them on staff, that might be an issue for staff where they all go at the same time, but they work that out. But in general, is that sometimes they'll go home, and like he says, they'll want to bring food from home back. So there's always that potential for movement of infected products. Now, on one hand, yeah, we think that's a high risk, but on the other hand, the farms that I've seen that happening on, they go to a lot of effort make resources, complete signage, and so on in the languages of the people that are working on their farms. So they're quite well educated about it, and it doesn't seem to be a risk. It's also very common, like as huge a risk as I thought it would be. It also is very common in Russia and in many of these farms in Europe that the owners of the farms will supply the food. So workers don't bring their own lunch. When you go into the kitchen at lunchtime, then there are these big vats of soup and so on will be passed through a window. Right by the window is where the serving area is, and somebody's serving lunch to everybody. And then that vat goes right back out. It might not, you know, be getting sort of UV light treatment or ozone treatment or something, but it's relatively biosecure as far as this is where it gets set. They take the lid off and serve the food, right? And here's the bags with the bread. You get the bread. And they control the sourcing on the food. So it's an interesting sort of approach and a fringe benefit of working on some of these farms. And so, you know, in Denmark, for example, they're like, yes, we use pork, but it's only Danish pork, and we know where it comes from, sort of thing. This is their approach, you know. So we deal with that sort of thing and try to think through the biosecurity of that.
I think about the cultural equivalent of beef jerky and how jerky can be carried anywhere, anytime, for anybody. And, you know, it's nice about mid-morning having a bite of beef jerky, but you're correct as far as bringing it in, making sure that you know where it came from, if it's going to be on there. Sean Paul, the takeaway that you got today that you will add now to your views of ASF practices, procedures, protocol.
You know, there are probably several components. In prevention, I think the role of people on infected food, I wasn't thinking that was that big, probably because of the perception right around that there's little interaction between tourist and agriculture in general in North America. But, you know, given other examples, that could be a clear opportunity for introduction, right? So that I changed a little bit my mind after today's discussion on that, given the history, you know, examples of outbreaks in other countries. In terms of early response, I wasn't thinking too much on ELISA. And if we fall into an endemic situation, even if it is only in the wild, you know, animal population, ELISA might be a good tool to have handy. So I was probably thinking too much of PCR, early detection, but that's a tool that we have to have ready in our labs to be able to contain. And then the rest, I would say that, you know, is pretty much what everybody's expecting. It's just the education, the training, the continuous communication that is key, and he emphasized that, and he called it the virus sociology, right? So you don't only think about virology or epidemiology, you have to think about the people, the farmers, and how they get compensated or don't, and how they have to still make a living out of that, and how the governments can push or not into some direction. So I think that's a big component that nobody has underestimated. We just need to keep thinking about it and making, you know, developing tools or thought to deal with it.
Thoughts on the vectors he described as being tested right now? I mean, there was a lot of conversation about flies on farms.
You know, we've been looking at our location assessment over the last couple of years, and I actually had a personal update from Jose Manuel about a year and a half ago. I asked him if he would mind just bringing me up to speed on things, and we did a Skype call. And after that conversation, you know, one of the slides he showed today, he used then, and he said that we should, you know, give some thought about where we place our facilities. Understand feral swine habitat, and if a new facility is going up, try not to put your new facility right in the midst of feral swine habitat or very close to it, because that makes it easier for there to be a carcass in the forest next to your farm that maybe somebody hasn't cleaned up yet, and for flies to move like that. It makes it easier for them to try to get close to your farm for some of the reasons he described, right? So in the location assessment, we added a, that we're reviewing, that we're beta testing right now, where the scoring changed a little bit from for feral swine, that you would get a lower deduction if you were further away from the habitat. And so as we've been beta testing this, the assessment, it's interesting, because we've looked at, okay, yes, the country's positive for feral swine. Are there feral swine within 10 kilometers? Yes. What's the closest distance, right? And is it less than 2 kilometers? And in some cases, you know, the farms are in a forest or right next to a forest, and others they're in the midst of some agricultural land with very little habitat. So it would be, you know, more difficult for them to get close to your farm. And it's not just that they're going to track contaminated feces or blood onto your yard, but it's more about that carcass thinking, that movement of flies from a carcass that's not detected, right? When you look at the controls in, programs in the feral swine outbreaks in Czech Republic and Belgium, there's a really big emphasis on paying people to get out there and hunt for carcasses every day. And then when they find one, they put a flag up and they do a rapid removal, like with hazmat suits and everything, and they handle that carcass. But they get that carcass out of there as quick as possible as part of the control program. So it makes a lot of sense when we're trying to protect our own farms, perhaps in an outbreak scenario, if we could just be further away from their habitat, right?
It was striking as he showed us the maps of the density of feral swine around the world, and in fact gave it as a reason that, well, China's going to have an issue and will have an issue for quite some time because of the density of feral swine. In your work, Marissa, how does that figure into the plan that we've been talking about?
So for feral swine, for the United States, we do have wildlife services, and as it stands right now, we are, any feral swine that's found dead, we are collecting samples, tissue samples from it, and then those samples get sent to our Plum Island, our foreign animal disease diagnostic lab. And on top of that, in addition to it, we are also collecting serum, and we're sending that for ELISA testing. So we are monitoring CSF both by PCR and ELISA testing, as well as PCR testing for ASF. Any feral swine that we come across that may have been hit by a car, we're not targeting. What we're really trying to do is find sick or dead feral swine that may have some sort of disease, some sort of pathology.
Last question. So monitoring, great point. What's the latest? What should we be doing on farm related to monitoring?
I'm probably the only region where we're actually able to do monitoring from the standpoint of a surveillance program at the request of our customers. So after the Belgian outbreak, the requests for surveillance in Western Europe went up, especially from Spain. Like Jose Manuel talked about today, they're quite worried, right? And so, well, they're doing part of what Spain's done unilaterally is any feeder pig movement that comes in, they do testing on those groups, and there's an inspection. So that's more of a association, government cooperation. From a breeding stock company standpoint, not all the customers ask for it, but some do. And so we are doing ASF PCR on serum from a 95% confidence, 5% prevalence approach as far as sample size goes. We do send those samples to the national reference labs, and we can do that anytime we want, right? It's not, there's not a limitation on us sending samples in for surveillance purposes. If they would get a positive, they would be required to report it and also send samples to the global reference lab, either at in Madrid or in Purebright in the UK. In Russia, it's been standard for the last 7-8 years, I think, that they do a certain percentage. I believe it's 10% of all animals 7 days pre-shipment of all of our sales. So it's a sort of a just-in-time pre-sale test. And they do it actually on whole blood. We only use serum in Western Europe because that's what some of the labs preferred. And yeah, I think those are the main things that we're doing as far as surveillance goes. Like Nadia said, our health assurance vet from Russia, there's some things that they have to do by law for all farms in Russia when it comes to mortalities on a monthly basis. So,
the thing you each saw today that most greatly concerned you?
I think the thing that alarmed me the most was his list of clinical signs. So he said, if you have these clinical signs, if you have 3 to 4 clinical signs, you see these criteria, you have ASF. And a lot of what he had up on there, we would see with our endemic pathogens. So to me, my concern is, are we numb to these clinical signs? Are we going to be able to identify signs of African swine fever if it does enter our U.S. herds?
And his comment was, even if you see 2, call the vet.
Right, and if we were to do that, we would be calling our state animal health vets every day for some of those signs. And that to me was pretty alarming. From my work, I knew that African swine fever, you know, has similarities with our endemic pathogens, PERS, you know, salmonella, anything that would cause septicemia. But seeing it there and hearing him say 3 to 4 signs you should be calling, you know, your government official, that was a little bit jarring for me.
It would be hard to be the first one to make the call, because I think you'd be saying, I think I might have a suspect case here, right? Because saying that you have the suspect case, that can really...
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Yeah, right. Whereas in countries that are already dealing with it, in Belgium or in, you know, in Russia, I mean, then it becomes sort of routine, right? Like, oh, I should be doing this, right? And it becomes a bit more routine for everybody. So then you're in a whole different... you're in a whole different stage at that point, and it's not very hard to do. Making that first call is pretty tough.
Right. So they've done some outbreak modeling, and they've said, you know, how long would it take us to detect African swine fever if it got to the U.S. herds? And this number might not be correct, but it's about 3 to 4 weeks that it would be here before we found it. And looking at what he put on there, because I was like, oh, you know, we'll find it before then. You know, give us 7 days. We'll find it. But seeing what he put up there and thinking about the model and thinking about how it's presenting, that model might actually be very accurate on how long it'll take us to actually detect it. And at that point, how far has it spread and what chance do we have to stamp it out?
No wonder he was preaching biosecurity.
Yeah.
What concerned me was the, you know, the numbers. He wasn't very optimistic on the rest of Asia. So he said Japan and South Korea are in really high imminent risk. So if you count the number of pigs that are produced in countries that are positive or will be positive pretty soon, according to his prediction, is 75% of the global swine population. So we can talk about risk and probabilities all day long, but as everybody knows that as you expand your exposure, that risk just goes up, right? So the more potential sources you have in the world, the higher the probability of transmission, right? So for those countries that leave out of exports and depend on exports, or for us as a genetic company that have elite genes in some countries, that's a tremendous risk. It's very concerning. So anything we can do, it's very important. So in our case in PIC, we're focusing on biosecurity. We just launched a initiative called BioShield is a basic biosecurity program to create that culture that we've been talking about. And then the other component is business continuity, right? Because our customers will need seamen, gills, and bores soon, and even in the face of an event. So I don't know, Marissa, you want to share a little bit of what we're doing to get as prepared as possible for that?
Sure. So part of an outcome of these exercises that we've had with USDA is, you know, what is going to be required for us if we do break with ASF? What can our farms do in order to maintain continuity of business? And what's come out of that is that each farm would need to have a premise ID, and on top of that, they would need to have a secure pork supply biosecurity plan. And essentially what the SPS plan does is it documents current biosecurity practices as well as what we would change in the event of a foreign animal disease. So what we're doing at PIC is we are developing SPS plans for all of our owned and tamed sites in order to be ready for if we do break with ASF. Something else that we're really focused on is developing relationships with state animal health officials and participating in these exercises that USDA and the states are putting on so that we are as up to date as possible with what the requirements will be if we do experience an outbreak.
You know, the great part, I was just gonna say the great part about that is that, you know, PIC, I think, has really looked to, certainly in our region, as a resource when it comes to biosecurity, outbreak investigations, health acclimation, all of these things. And so I think getting involved at this level in the U.S., it will help other groups within our industry to see the value in it and hopefully follow. So that can only be good, I think, for the wider industry.
Joining us on The Squeal today were Health Assurance Veterinarian Dr. Marissa Rotolo, Dr. Tim Snyder, Health Assurance Director for PIC Europe, and Dr. Jean-Paul Cano, Health Assurance Director for PIC Americas. You're welcome to share this podcast widely in your organization. In fact, we encourage it. For PIC, the international leader of continuous genetic improvement in swine breeding stock and in world-class technical support to the global pork supply chain, I'm Ned Arthur. Thanks for joining us.